This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Marla Damati. Today on this show, the most effective aid after a disaster is sending money, as it can be used to cover those immediate needs, which is why Save the Children Fiji is helping roll out a new ultra-fast method of delivering financial support via mobile phones.
We have selected households who have met our vulnerability criteria, and they are receiving 4 cash payments directly to their electronic wallets.
Coming up, you'll hear why it might be a game changer in providing aid. And while many places in the Pacific are still waiting for the COVID-19 vaccines to reach their shores, other regions like the Northern Marianas have started their vaccination rollouts. In 30 minutes' time, we'll check in with CNMI and see how their vaccination programs are going. But next, Solomon Islands' plan to ban Facebook seems to be no more.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
There's been a collective sigh of relief from many people in Solomon Islands after the government apparently shelved its plan to ban Facebook. Late last year, it announced a plan to temporarily ban the social media platform while it worked out how to stamp out cyberbullying and abuse. Now, though, the communications minister has told local media the government does not want to be seen as dictating people's lives. Liam Fox reports.
Regina Lepping says the announcement last year that the government was going to ban Facebook sent her and other young entrepreneurs in the country scrambling.
There are young people, there are entrepreneurs who rely on Facebook to get connected with people and, you know, to advertise, since everything is always expensive around here. And then to have that all of a sudden a call for banning Facebook, it's just like everyone don't know what to do. Activating new accounts everywhere and trying to get the same kind of audience they have on Facebook.
She welcomes what appears to be a back down on the Facebook ban by the communications minister, but says the government could have handled the issue far better.
I feel like, you know, you can't just make up such a decision and then do that, and then next minute you change your mind, like, I'm not going to do that anymore. You're playing with people's lives, actually, and especially people who are trying to survive in this time of pandemic. I just hope that they recall that and actually look more clearly into it.
Last year, to much consternation both inside and outside the country, the government announced it was going to temporarily ban Facebook. It said the move was aimed at tackling cyberbullying and online defamation. Prime Minister Manasa Sogavare went as far as to say the move was about preserving national unity and people's happy coexistence. Now, though, it appears the ban won't be going ahead. The communications minister, Peter Chanel Agovaka, was quoted by Solomon Business magazine as saying Facebook will not be suspended. He reportedly said the government does not want to be seen to be dictating people's lives. No other public statement on the issue has been made by the minister or anyone else from the government. Matthew Wale is the opposition leader.
The way things work here, it probably is an indication of a decision that has been made or is about to be made, but that the minister and his ministry are leaning towards not proceeding with the ban. I welcome it. A ban, obviously, on Facebook is not the only way to address the concerns, legitimate concerns that the government had as grounds for that proposal.
Mr. Wale says the government should have considered other options before jumping straight to a ban.
The initial response should have been, well, let's talk to Facebook. What can we do with Facebook short of a ban? Secondly, they are talking about amending the Telecommunications Act to require SIM cards in the Solomon Islands to be registered to individuals. So that, I think, will also reduce the scope for anonymous abuse.
The proposed ban prompted plenty of discussion among Solomon Islanders, including on the Yumi Tok Tok Facebook page. The page's founder and administrator is Ben Afuga.
I think I would say around 80% of those that commented are against the decision of the government to suspend Facebook.
He too welcomes the government's backflip As an administrator of a popular Facebook page, he agrees there is a need to stamp out abusive behaviour by anonymous users. He supports the government's move to implement a wide-ranging cyber crime law.
Because there are other other platforms, and the tendency is that when people, when Facebook is shut down, people will turn to other platforms. And what is the government going to do? Because people are going to do the same things that they did on Facebook in those other platforms.
Ben Afuga, founder of the Yumi Tok Tok Facebook page, ending that report from Liam Fox.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
A new ultra-fast method of delivering financial aid to people affected by COVID-19 is being rolled out in Fiji. Mobile phones are at the centre of the program, which will deliver digital cash payments to approximately 18,000 households over the next 4 months. It will be the largest humanitarian cash transfer in Fiji's history, according to Save the Children, the non-for-profit organisation administering the assistance. And as Fiji based Chief Executive Shairana Ali explains to Marion Farr, it could be a game changer when it comes to delivering aid during natural disasters.
So mobile phones are very effective. In Fiji, we have Vodafone, which is a very sophisticated platform called the M-Pesa platform, which is used by many people in Fiji to receive and send money to purchase goods from markets, including supermarkets. And so we have selected households who have met our vulnerability criteria, and they are receiving 4 cash payments directly to their electronic wallets on the phone. There's an app, and you can actually go in. You can choose your items that you need to purchase. You can go to the counters, and you can tap your QR code, and the money would be deducted automatically from your M-Pesa account balance to pay for the items.
And what about those people who don't have smartphones? Are they able to access this in any way?
So that is the beauty of this technology, that it's able to link up with other, service providers. So even if you don't have a smartphone, you just have a normal, regular phone, there is a system in place that Vodafone has created. So you can use that text code, you can take your phone to any of the Vodafone outlets, and they will be able to dispense the cash to you.
How many people have you already administered aid to in this way, or how many people have already started receiving money in this way?
In terms of our target, we have 14,000 households who will be receiving the cash transfer to digital wallets, and up to 4,000 households will receive a one-off assistance via a special needs fund that we have established. So at the moment, we have reached more than 3,000 households with assistance, and we will be providing assistance until April to reach our target of 18,000 households altogether.
How have these, recipients been assessed in terms of, their needs and their eligibility for this assistance?
Basically, we are only assisting communities and beneficiaries who have no source of income at the moment, who have been affected by COVID-19 or have lost their jobs because of COVID-19. So people in the tourism sector, they've already been affected living in poverty, but because of COVID-19, the situation has become worse. We are also looking at, for the special needs fund, it's children living with disabilities, families living with disabilities, also looking at survivors of domestic violence, single mothers, single parents, grandparents who are looking after their grandchildren. So those are some of the criteria we use to select beneficiaries for the assistance.
Now, this program is sort of initially being used to deliver relief and help to people affected by COVID-19 in Fiji. But how will this potentially be a game changer in terms of administering assistance around natural disasters like cyclones and earthquakes that we are seeing, even more frequently in the Pacific?
We do recognize that during disasters, people's access to banks and other places are cut off, and people immediate need is cash to be able to prepare for disasters, but also be able to purchase things as soon as when the disaster strikes. So the partnership with Vodafone phone is quite critical, especially for COVID-19 and for Tropical Cyclone Yasa, because we are able to basically upload those who need assistance on a database, and these people are able to receive money immediately, and the money is transferred seamlessly, and they're able to use that to purchase from local markets. So yes, the technology works. We know it works, and we can see that it can be rolled out quite efficiently for future responses.
And what happens if the mobile network is severely sort of damaged by something like a tropical cyclone or an earthquake?
Yeah, so that's something that we are also in talks with Vodafone to find out if, you know, if the network goes down, what are the other options available? Link into other forms of assistance, for example, transferring funds through the post office is one option, but also looking at, for the financial service providers, Vodafone and others, for them to build their capacity to be able to address such issues and be prepared, better prepared, to make sure that these services are protected to the best of their abilities and that, you know, it's up and running quite quickly after the disaster strike.
Do you hope this will be implemented elsewhere in the Pacific?
Yeah, so I do understand that other countries are also doing their own cash preparedness work, particularly Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands. I'm hopeful that, you know, this technology can be rolled out in other countries as well.
And just one last question. In terms of Tropical Cyclone Yasa, how is the recovery effort going and what are we seeing on the ground?
What we are seeing on the ground at the moment is a very much coordinated approach to ensure that all communities that have been affected are receiving assistance. We have been working closely with our partners on the ground. We have a team on the ground in the most affected communities. And what we are observing is that, you know, schools are being repaired with the support of the government and also with the Australian team that's on the ground. Schools are being made ready for school. We are also seeing that children are bouncing back, meaning that they're recovering from trauma that they experienced during TC Yasa. There's a lot of support that our team, Save the Children team, is providing on the ground. They're providing psychosocial support. They're also facilitating sessions for children in the child-friendly spaces that have been established. We are also seeing reports of disease outbreaks. So there is obviously, you know, a need for hygiene-related training and also sanitation and hygiene kits. So that is being done as well. But overall, there is definitely, you know, a lot of resilience in the communities, and the swift response from the government and, you know, other organizations has really, you know, given the communities and families assurance that help is there, and timely intervention has helped them help their mindset and gotten them back into the positive spirit of rebuilding.
That was Fiji-based Chief Executive of Save the Children, Shairana Ali, speaking with Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Still to come, you'll get a weather outlook for the weekend ahead from Nandraki's Neville Coop, and Talia Olatia brings you the stories making news. But first, some music. This is Electric Fields with their song Vision. That gorgeous track was Vision by Electric Field. What a gorgeous song for this Friday. It's time now to get a weather update from the director of Nandraki Weather, Neville Coop. Good morning, Nbula, Neville.
Hi, Marla.
It sounds like it's stinking hot in Fiji and pretty much across the region right now.
That's right, yeah. So we have the South Pacific Convergence Zone sitting well to the south of us, basically across New Caledonia and then southward, well south of Tonga. So everywhere north of that, which is pretty much all of the Pacific Islands of any note, are in the northerly airflow on the north side of that. So that's dragging warm, moist air from nearer the equator down over the island. So it's pretty hot and steamy. It's going to stay that way through the weekend.
And what about next week? Is there any kind of inklings of something might happen, or is it still staying pretty normalish or pretty non-weathered until the end of the month?
Yeah, look, it's going to stay pretty quiet around us, that's for sure. Not much change to this pattern. So, yeah, it's pretty nasty out there during the middle part of the day, so try and avoid doing too much if you can. But here in Fiji, we actually end our brief flirtation with daylight saving this Sunday, so clocks will go back an hour, meaning that the sun is up a tad earlier, an hour earlier. So that means that things warm up in the morning quicker than they are at the moment. So it's going to be pretty much the same right through probably to the end of the month around our part of the world. It looks like it's going to start picking up around the top end of Australia and Indonesia later this month, but it won't get out into the Coral Sea and closer to the islands probably till early part of February.
Well, that was a good reminder that daylight savings is ending in Fiji on Sunday, and to keep hydrated and make sure you do stay in that shade in that hottest part of the day. But Neville, thank you very much for that, and I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. And for weather updates at any time, just head on over to Facebook and type in Nandraki Weather. It is time now to get a look at what's making news around the region and beyond. And to do that this morning, I'm joined by Talia Olatia. Good morning, Talia.
Good morning, Marla.
Now, nearly a month after Cyclone Yasa hit Fiji, there have been multiple reports of typhoid in the country.
That's right. So even before Cyclone Yasa hit, officials in Fiji were concerned about the spread of disease in the wake of the cyclone. And those fears have been very much founded with multiple reports of typhoid. Now, a quick reminder, typhoid is a bacterial infection that can lead to fever, headaches, abdominal pain and mild vomiting. And one of the big risk factors for typhoid is poor sanitation and poor hygiene, which, you know, is very common after the destruction of a cyclone like we saw in Fiji. So in Fiji's northern division, 10 cases of typhoid have been confirmed, while the government says that there are also 8 cases in Mathawada and 2 in Savu Savu. 3 of these people are in hospitals in Lambasa and Savu Savu as well. As a result, health teams are carrying out contract tracing and have collected water samples from the affected areas where movement is being restricted in the hopes of stopping the spread of typhoid.
Well, hopefully they can get it under control before it does spread further there. Now let's turn to PNG with some sad news that National Sevens coach Douglas has died.
Yeah, so the Sunday Bulletin, which is a PNG-owned weekly newspaper, is reporting that Douglas Guise, the coach of the National Sevens team and former PNG Rugby Sevens player himself, died suddenly yesterday while training in Port Moresby. Now, the cause of death is still unknown, but his death is being called a great loss for rugby union in PNG. There have been lots of outpourings on social media. On Facebook, Lachlan wrote, "One of the best players, coaches, but even a better person. Rugby is a gentleman's sport, and you, Douglas, the truest gentleman out." And Josh on Twitter says, "Douglas Guise identifies a man so synonymous with the code in this country, where if you knew rugby, then you knew Dougie, adding that he was eager to see guys take PNG sevens into another HSBC circuit. This sad news comes just 2 weeks after the loss of another well-known coach, this time PNG tennis coach and former athlete Kualam Apisa, who we will know on the program is the father of Abigail Terry Apisa, who is a really phenomenal tennis player, obviously takes after her dad. Just really sad news coming out of PNG today.
Absolutely, Vale, to those two integral people in PNG's sporting world. Now let's go to the Netherlands, where the foreign affairs ministers have added their voice to a call for the UN to visit West Papua.
Yeah, that's right. So the Asia Pacific report is reporting that the Netherlands, which people will know is Indonesia's former coloniser, has become the 83rd international state to call for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to be allowed into West Papua. It comes after questions were directed at the Dutch Foreign Affairs Minister, Stef Blok, in Parliament this week, and he responded by saying, quote, "It is important to have such a visit by the High Commissioner as soon as possible." Minister Blok also noted that the Dutch government was aware of a large number of organisations opposing the renewal of Indonesia's special autonomy provisions in West Papua. And in the Netherlands as well, there is a petition that is going around that's actually garnered more than 500,000 signatures. The Netherlands now joins, as we know, the 18 states in the Pacific Islands Forum who also called for the UN High Commissioner to be allowed into West Papua back in August 2019.
Something we'll definitely keep our eye on here on Pacific Beat and ABC Radio Australia. Finally, the story that I am very excited to both talk about, hear about and share. Tell me why a racing pigeon, that's right, a racing pigeon named Joe has captured the world's, including my, attention.
Mm-hmm. I went onto a deep, deep dive last night into pigeon racing news. And it is truly amazing. Now, I just want to let people know that normally when I bring these news wraps stories is I look around different things, collate it so it's like a nice bite-sized piece of news. But I feel that today, the best person who can do that is Australian reporter Nick McCallum, who did it so well on Twitter that I'm just going to read his tweet. It goes, "Shock twist in the story of Joe the Pigeon, who found his way from Alabama in the US to Melbourne, Australia, after getting lost during a race. The Australian federal government considers him a biosecurity risk and confirmed he will be euthanized. The man who found Joe is devastated."
What a way.
That tweet should win a Walkley. I literally did not know the story of Joe the Pigeon until I read that tweet and I was like, what ride did I just go on? So a little bit more information. And this is from the Associated Press. Joe, the little pigeon, travelled 15,000 kilometres across the Pacific Ocean before arriving in a man called Kevin Chellybird's backyard. That is his name, which people will see the bird and go, oh my God, his name is Bird. But also Chelly, like Uccelli in Italian, is birds. So his name is literally Bird. Anyway, this pigeon turned up in his backyard on Boxing Day, absolutely exhausted and skinny because, I mean, he's just travelled 15,000 kilometres. Experts believe that he was racing in October. There must have been like a strong wind that kind of blew him out to the Pacific Ocean, and then he must have hitched a ride on a cargo ship because otherwise how did he make the ride? Anyway, the Oklahoma-based American Pigeon Union has confirmed that Joe is registered to an owner in Montgomery, Alabama, but the owner has not been able to be reached. Now, maybe Joe should have gone to New Zealand because, as Nick McCallum reported, Joe will have to be euthanized in Australia due to our quarantine and inspection service laws that are notoriously strict. I don't think I need to remind people about the saga that was Johnny Depp's dog's pistol and boo, but it's literally another case of that. And as I said, it has really captured the world's attention. International outlets, including Time magazine, is reporting on Joe the Pigeon.
Joe the Pigeon wound up in a backyard in Australia after flying 15,000 kilometres. That is a lot of kilometres. Mm. And he hitched a ride on a cargo, and unfortunately he, as of now, met his unfortunate fate of potentially being euthanized.
He hasn't
been put down yet.
And I feel that there's a lot of groundswell going around. But the question that I ask, what happens to other migratory animals and other birds that turn up into Australia? Like, what happens to them?
Is it because Joe is specifically from the United States?
Well, the only reason why they know that is because he had a little tag on his leg. And so when Kevin Chellybird found him, he did research to find out where this tag came from, and it found out to be the United States. But on the chance that during that long trip, that little tag thing fell off, who's going to know where the racing pigeon comes from?
Well, exactly. And also, can't he just go to one of those hotel quarantine sites for 14 days and then, you know, after 14 days, pay the fee?
Is going to pay the quarantine? These are the big questions.
I feel like there could potentially be a groundswell of fundraising support or a GoFundMe for Joe. But Talia, thank you so much for bringing us those stories and brightening my Friday.
Thanks, Mala.
That was Talia Olatia bringing you the stories making news in the region and across the world.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
I'm Marla Damati and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I've got some big news for you. From Monday, the Pacific Beat team will be bringing you 2 fresh hours every weekday morning full of news, analysis, but also the latest song releases from the Pacific, as well as the big issues in sport. And we'll also be meeting a range of inspirational people from the Pacific across the year. And as always, we love hearing from you and want to include you in our views and stories on air too. In 2021. The best way to get in touch is via our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. Just send us a message.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
I just want to play you a touch more music. I know I've played this one this week already, but it's just such a fantastic track. It's by Fijian-born Lapani. It's Wait to Wake Me Up.
Bad start, bad day. Hard work, no play. Sad faces all around me and I feel the same. I can feel the pain, yeah. Broke car, broke phone. Broke bank, broke home, yeah. Heartbroken, I can't believe that I'm in this again. Looking forward to my bed tonight. Turn my pillow to the coldest side. I'd do anything to close my eyes and feel alive till the stars align. When all of my dreams wanna go for a walk, and I don't wanna talk about the day you wanna end. So could you remember to wait to wake you up again?
That was Wait to Wake Me Up Again by Fijian-born Lapani.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Marla Damati. Now, if 2020 was all about COVID-19, then the start of 2021 is all about the COVID vaccine. Here in Australia and for most countries in the South Pacific, we're still waiting for our vaccine allocations. So while we wait, we look to places like the Northern Marianas, who have already started their COVID-19 vaccine rollout as a part of Operation Warp Speed. Esther Muna is the CEO for Healthcare Corporation in the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Island and is overseeing the vaccine rollout there. She joins me this morning. Good morning, Esther.
Good morning. Good morning. And half a day and Tirawami from Saipan.
Well, thank you for joining us from Saipan to chat all things vaccine rollout where you are now. Can you tell me about the vaccine rollout? How has it been going?
It's actually been going pretty well. We just started around January 9th the dose 2 to complete the series of those individuals that have taken their first dose. And we are basically continuing on. Today we are focusing only on dose 1, as 21 days ago was Christmas Day, so we did not do any vaccine rollout that day. So this will be our first dose for those people that will be taking this. We're rolling it out today.
Now, what vaccines does the Northern Marianas have?
We have both the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer.
Now, what does a successful rollout look for you? You're saying that some people are getting their second doses and you are doing some first doses now. How many people need to be vaccinated in the Northern Marianas to ensure herd immunity?
We were told, or basically I'm not the scientist in the Marianas, but based on the information that was provided to us, we were looking at 70%. However, we are targeting a higher percentage of about maybe 90%. If we could get that amount, that would be perfect for the Northern Mariana Islands, which actually have kept the numbers pretty low in the territory.
Now, what has the take-up been of the vaccination? You said you're aiming for more than 70% coverage, but what has it like been on the ground in terms of people getting their vaccines? How is it going in that stance?
Okay, so what we have realized is, the people really want these vaccines. They want to get these shots to their arms. We thought there would be a higher percentage of hesitancy. So we tried to get the messages out there to the community. We actually used leaders in the community to get their first dose. We had the, CNMI is a Catholic community. We had the Bishop of the Northern Mariana Islands basically get his vaccine first. And that has really pushed, the elders, the individuals that have really stayed at home during the time of, a response and protecting themselves, they want to get these vaccines. So it's been really successful messaging out there. The only thing right now that we're actually trying to get the message out right now is that people have to wait their turn. Unfortunately, and this is because all through the United States, there is, it's basically inadequate. I mean, insufficient number of vaccines. We in the Pacific, along with several of the U.S. affiliated Pacific Islands, have requested CDC and the U.S. to get our vaccines in bulk, so that we can, properly plan these vaccine rollouts and get them out to the people. Unfortunately, we're getting them in allocations, and based on what we are learning today is that, if we get these shots to the arms, the allocations can be better. So we are definitely trying to roll them out to people that want it.
Absolutely. Now, talking about people rolling up their sleeves and getting that, it sounds quite logistically a bit difficult in terms of getting allocations versus a bulk, and also keeping some of those vaccines, especially the Pfizer one, in the cold storage chains that needs to be done. How is it going logistically wise in terms of keeping those vaccines cold and also ensuring that people do come in for that second dosage?
Yes, so it's a lot of it is really having a great data system. So you're right. I mean, it's keeping. It's a very complex process. We do have the ultra cold temperature freezers located at our hospital facility, and so where the location of the vaccine rollout is really just in the same campus. So there were tents that were built in response to the COVID outbreak, and making sure that we have an available area for in case there's a surge. So that area, because we did not get that surge, we are using that area, that specific area, as an area for the vaccine rollout. So it's located near the facility. The ER is right across the road, and then making sure that the data is in real time. Making sure that the information information of what vaccine they're getting, whether it's Moderna, whether it's Pfizer. Those things needed to be in place before we actually roll them out. And yes, you know, that's why one of the reasons too, as we explained to the media the other day, was that, you know, 400 was a cap that we selected simply because we know this is going to be, it has to be sustainable. It's going to be long-term. And we needed to make sure that the staff, the space, and the vaccines are actually adequate for us to roll out on a daily basis. So it really does require the data management, the supply management, the control of the vaccines to ensure that, you know, it meets the amount when you take it out, you thaw it out, you make sure that you refrigerate it for how long? It's about 6 hours. And then when you put it into the syringe, you have about 2 hours. And Moderna is actually 2.5 hours to use them. So those things are very, very, you're right, logistically, it is very specific, technical, to make sure that when we get them to the arms of the people, that it's also a safe one.
Absolutely. And obviously then there has to be some sort of security there in terms of managing the security of those getting vaccinated, but also those vaccines that are being stored. What security is there in terms of protecting healthcare workers and also that supply that you do have?
So we do have, thank you for that question, we do have a lot of government agencies that are involved in this process. We have the Department of Public Safety. We have about 125 people, over about 125 people that are there. And they're not only from the healthcare workers. They are from different agencies who are participating, guiding people, registering them. So we expect, we prefer that people register online before they get there. But we, of course, you know, we have people in the Pacific. Internet is not ideal or even available for some people. So we have that on-site registration as well. But yes, security is, you know, even for picking up the vaccines at the airport, we make sure that the police, you know, escort those vaccines to the facility. And yes, that process has to be there.
You're listening to Esther Muna, the CEO for Healthcare Corporation in the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Island. Has the vaccine rollout changed people's perception in the country in regards to COVID-19? Potentially, we're talking increased confidence and maybe optimism about returning to somewhat COVID normal. Is that happening as these vaccines begin to roll out?
It is. But at the same time, we have not changed our protocol. So in the Northern Mariana Islands, we do have a strict protocol of quarantine protocol when you arrive. So, you know, we are basically putting you in the government site for 5 days, at least complete the 5 days. We test you on day one, then test you on day five. We have availability of testing. So we make sure that we identify individuals that have the COVID if they're identified as COVID positive. And because of these vaccine rollouts, right now working with CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, what they have advised us, and we are listening to that, is that, you know, we are not going to be changing our protocols, especially with the new variant that is, you know, we're keeping an eye on that. And we wanted to make sure that our people still continue to be safe. And, you know, we have some normalcy that have been coming up here because of our low numbers. Right now we are 128 positive cases, and we have managed to maintain that. And it's mainly from the airport, from the borders versus in the community. So that has been successful for us. So the vaccine kind of just basically assures that they're, you know, that, of course, that when if they do get it and if there is a community transmission, that their level of illnesses is not, you know, will not impact their will not worsen when they do get the positive case.
Now, finally, we were talking about, you know, making sure that those protocols are still in place because COVID is still around. And especially now, are there concerns for you and, you know, your team of health professionals about the new UK and South African strains of the virus as well?
Yes, definitely we are. And that's one of the reasons why our protocol remains. You know, we are going to be making some changes, of course, if we get more increase in vaccine population. But, you know, for now, we are still maintaining the same protocol. We're keeping an eye on that. And as you know, North Mariana Islands is a U.S. Territory, and right now CDC requires that 72 hours before you enter the North Mariana Islands from a foreign country, you have to have a PCR test from your origin.
Esther, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Pacific Beat and giving us such a comprehensive update about the situation in the Northern Marianas in terms of vaccinations. We really thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
That was Esther Muna, the CEO for Healthcare Corporation in the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, speaking to me there from Saipan.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
The shutdown of religious activity doesn't just affect the faithful. 20 of the 25 biggest welfare agencies in Australia are faith-based.
It is the case that the charities connected with the churches, and particularly its welfare agencies dealing with the homeless, youth, aged care facilities, all of these things are so critical for the wider community now, and the churches are at the forefront of them. They're not-for-profits. They're there because they believe it's their mission, because the Christian tradition is a tradition of care and compassion reaching out. So if those things start to suffer in such a way that they have to be closed down, that is extremely serious for the wider community. Having said that, it's remarkable how agile and imaginative the charities are.
Religion and Ethics, Wednesdays at 5:30 p.m. on Radio Australia.
On June 16 of last year, a tragedy took place that shook Melbourne's Pacifica community to its core. 15-year-old Solomone Tafulanaki was allegedly stabbed to death outside Brimbank Shopping Centre in the city's west. 9 boys and 2 young men have been charged with murder. Most have pleaded not guilty and are awaiting trial. But the tragedy has left deep scars in the community. This is a group of Pacifica youth performing a dance to commemorate Solo shortly after his death. One woman who knew Solo well is Vaifoa Galuenga. Solo was a close friend with her teenage son, and their families went to the same church. Miss Galuenga was there at the moment when Solo passed away. Now 6 months on from what she says was the hardest day of her life, Miss Galuenga speaks with reporter Marion Farr about how Melbourne's Pacifica community is coping in the wake of the tragedy.
For my family, it has affected us so much. My son, every now and then he just cries at night and wails for his best friend. He misses him. And every now and then, you know, I have my moments too. Just I feel like the trauma that it's caused my family has been pretty deep. But, you know, I'm just grateful that we belong to a church where we know that, you know, we believe in an afterlife, and we believe that we can see Solo again, so we're holding on to that hope, and that brings a bit of peace to us. But I don't let my boys catch the bus to school anymore. Like, I feel apprehensive about things that might happen still. You know, I just feel like things need to change and to be better. Like, it's a ripple effect that affects not only, you know, the ones that were there, but the families, like Solo's family especially. They've lost a son and a brother, and they can never get him back. Even myself, I wish I could have done more and saved him that day.
What do you believe are the sort of key issues that have led up to this?
I feel like social media has, you know, a big part of that. I feel like a lot of bullying and words have been thrown about on social media, and I feel like that can affect and really roll up someone's attitude to lead to what decisions that they make. To be honest, I feel like it starts at home. Like, there's some really good Pacific Islander children out there, and they've been brought up the right way, and it's the parents that teach their children the things that they need to do, you know, the skills and tools that they need to face this life. And I feel like this generation is a harder generation to live in because of all the extra things that they have, like social media. It's also, you know, if the community can open up their eyes to helping and giving the benefit of the doubt to our community, which is the Pacific Islander community, then I feel like, you know, it can work. We can live in a peaceful community together if everyone plays their part. And if there's more, maybe if there's more programs and facilities for our people, the Islander community, to use.
One thing that was implemented sort of immediately after the tragedy was a program by Charis Mentoring called the Village Response Program, specifically sort of engaging with Pacifica youth. Do you believe that program has had an impact since Solo's death?
Yeah, absolutely. These are the programs that are helping our community to be better and to grow and to overcome, you know, the stereotypes that we face and the struggles that we have as a Pacific Islander community. I feel like it's definitely helped. My son, my oldest son, Calvary, was actually part of Charis Mentoring, and he really enjoyed it while he was in there.
Do you feel that the community has come together and supported each other in the wake of this?
100%, yeah, I really do. Just seeing all the love that the community and even the greater community, like nationwide, even throughout New Zealand, we've just felt so much love. And I pray, and I'm sure that Solo's family felt that love too. I know that they acknowledged the love of the community and the generosity and the way that they came together and showed love.
One of the concerns at the time was around how this incident would influence broader sort of views or attitudes towards the Pacifica community more broadly. Has that happened? Has that been an issue?
No, not at all. I feel like, you know, after Solo's death, there were other gang-related deaths that happened that weren't part of the Polynesian community. So it's definitely a problem, but I don't feel it's isolated to just a Pacifica community. I feel like it's just a problem that needs to be dealt with. That's overall nationalities.
You spoke a little bit earlier about your ongoing fears as a parent. What more do you believe needs to be done to prevent something like this from happening again, and so you as a parent can feel safe and certain about your kids in the community?
I think parents, if they could talk to their children, have that open communication and let them know, you know, that they're there and that they care and that they're going to support them. And, you know, children will be more inclined to speak to them. Like, for myself and my children, we have a very close relationship. They tell me about their crushes and they tell me about their day, and even the things that they get up to that are not so good, they would tell me. And I'm grateful that they can do that, so that I can teach them, like, you know, they can be reprimanded and I can tell them the right thing to do or teach them the right thing that they should know. Because sometimes kids don't, they really don't know. Like, sometimes they haven't had that life experience. The only thing I ever want to do really is to honour Solo. To our family, he's a hero. We go to visit his grave now and then, and, you know, every time I drive past the place, you know, he's never far from my mind and my thoughts. And we pray continually for his family. We love his family. His parents are the most beautiful parents that I've witnessed. We just pray that, you know, we can get through this together.
That was Vaifoa Galuinga speaking there to Marion Farr.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
I think it's time for a little bit more music. This is Go Farther in Lightness by Gang of Youths.
It's the weirdest high and the lowest peak. God, I'm here. I'm on goddamn street. I climb some wall and curse out my favorite team and stare at the freeway, inveterately free. Go farther in hope. Go farther. Go farther in lightness. Go farther in hope. Go farther. Go farther in lightness.
That was Go Father in Lightness by Gang of Youths.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Just in case you missed it, the Pacific Beat team will be bringing you 2 fresh hours every weekday morning full of news and analysis, but also the latest song releases from the Pacific, as well as the big issues in sport. And you'll also be meeting a range of inspirational people from the Pacific across the year. And as always, we do love hearing from you. The best way to get in touch is via our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. Just send us a message.
Island Music brings you the finest reggae from Jamaica and around the world with a spotlight on the freshest Pacifica talent.
Join me, Rick Howe, for Island Music, a 2-hour journey from the foundation of Jamaican popular music from ska, rocksteady, roots, dub and dancehall, plus the freshest new releases and a spotlight on emerging talent from around the Pacific.
Every Saturday with Rick Howe from 12 till 2pm PNG time on Radio Australia across the Pacific.
That's the program. Don't forget that Jordan Fennell will be along at 3pm PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. I'm Marla Damati. Thank you so much for your company this week. Wishing you a wonderful Friday and an absolutely excellent weekend.